Welcome to the debrief, everybody. A Fort Worth police officer who quit his job after he shot an African-American woman through her bedroom window and killed her is now himself charged with murder. Officer Aaron Dean was wearing this body cam in the overnight hours between Friday and Saturday. A concerned neighbor called a non-emergency police number because the door of a Tatiana Jefferson's home was open. Within seconds of arriving, Officer Dean saw Jefferson through a bedroom window, opened fire, and killed her. He was never attacked. The victim of the shooting, Tatiana Jefferson, was a pre-med graduate of Xavier University and sold equipment for the pharmaceutical industry. She had her door open to enjoy the cool breeze. The officer who pulled the trigger, Aaron Dean, was arrested at his attorney's office last night. He posted a $200,000 bond and left jail a few hours later. The police chief who once managed this officer asked the public not to judge the other 1,700 officers in his department and said his officers are thanking him for arresting Aaron Dean. Then the chief became emotional when asking questions from reporters.
I don't have any officers saying this action should not have been taken against this individual, this officer. I'm getting the complete opposite response. Chief, thank you for being quick and decisive. This is going to help heal us. The officers are hurting. I've been out there on patrol, and since this occurred, and it's the officer, they come up and hug, and it's very emotional because the officers, they try hard every day to try to make this city better. I likened it yesterday to some of our officers that are out there every weekend and most weeknights that they're out there trying to build these relationships, and I likened it to a bunch of ants building an ant hill, and then somebody comes with a hose and washes it away, and they just have to start from scratch and build over.
Attorney Lee Merritt is working with the victim's family in this case. I think that he's back with us on the debrief. Lee, can you hear me okay?
I can hear you fine, thank you.
How's the victim's family doing?
The victim's family is actually at the funeral home now, having the first real interaction with Tatiana's body, and it's a difficult day.
The chief publicly prayed at a news conference today for the family of Tatiana Jefferson and is promising to move his department to what he called better than best practices. What are your reaction to his words today?
Well, it's hard to react to words. This is a department that has demonstrated a propensity towards violence, and it's good to start with words. But unless they're followed up with serious, severe, and quick action, then they're just hollow promises.
You know, we heard the chief say he's going to bring in independent advisors to try to move the department forward, so I'm sure that the public there in Fort Worth will hold him to that. I have to ask you about this, too. Much controversy being made over police releasing body camera images showing what presumably was the victim's gun. Police singled it out and highlighted it when they released that recording. Was that, in your opinion, necessary?
It wasn't necessary, and it wasn't a strategical error. It was intentional. And we saw when they released the police warrant now for the arrest of this officer that they built in a claim that this officer, or that he was confronted with a gun poking out of the window or pointing out of the window. We hadn't heard that before. Obviously, that's not in the recording. And there's no evidence to support that, seeing that the window was sealed and the curtains were drawn. The only thing that could be used to support that was an alleged statement by an 8-year-old witness who was traumatized from the event.
Yeah, that's the next thing I had to ask you about, sir. The arrest warrant for the former officer contains that statement that you mentioned from Tatiana Jefferson's nephew who was with her when she was shot. According to the police documents, he says she took her handgun from her purse. Jefferson raised her handgun and pointed it toward the window. The video we just showed is a little bit hard to see, and it's not clear that that's what happened from the video, but that's what the child says. And he says that's when she was shot. If that's true, does that in any way make the officer's actions reasonable?
No, not at all. So, number one, we have to remember that that's what the 8-year-old child, that's not necessarily what the 8-year-old child says. That's what law enforcement says the 8-year-old child says. However, even if that were the case, when you're prowling about someone's property at 30 in the morning, it is natural, if they have a firearm present, for them to go recover that firearm and to have a look at what happened. That wouldn't justify shooting in this situation. And so it still would be an unlawful are trained, when they see a firearm, they must shout gun, 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 especially when you have a partner present, because you want to protect them from the potential of fire, being rounds being shot at them. You never heard anyone shout gun, because in my from all evidence, besides the alleged testimony of this 8-year-old, there was no gun involved in this incident until after they went into the home.
I'm sure we'll be talking about this case for quite some time together. Attorney Lee Merritt, thanks for joining us on The Debrief tonight. Earlier today on the Law and Crime Network, Attorney Ben Crump addressed civil rights cases involving police shootings. His new book provides his thoughts on this topic.
When you have an interaction with police officers, whether you live or die should not be determined by the color of your skin or the status of your mental condition. Many times we're seeing that police shoot first and ask questions later when it's people of color or disenfranchised people. But what we want is this concept of equal justice under the law. The argument we make in this book is we want America not just to recite the Declaration of Independence, but we want them to act like they believe the Declaration of Independence.
Let's move on to some other high-profile cases making headlines now. Actor Cuba Gooding Jr. appeared in court today to answer to sex abuse charges. Prosecutors have filed criminal charges based on the accusations of two women, but they went further and added a so-called pattern of conduct involving a total of 12 women. The actor denies all of the accusations. His attorney even compared him to former Vice President Joe Biden, saying accusations of unwanted touching against both men have been taken out of proportion. Actress Felicity Huffman, meanwhile, begins her federal sentence today. The actress reported to a prison in California where she will spend the next 14 days. Huffman pleaded guilty last month to her role in a massive college admissions cheating scandal. Now to a defendant who took the stand after Florida prosecutors accused him of murdering his pregnant ex-girlfriend. Markeith Lloyd is the defendant who admits he shot and killed 24-year-old Sade Dixon. Her brother, Ronald Stewart, was shot and injured. While on the run, Lloyd shot and killed a police officer, but most of the details of that case are for a separate trial. Lloyd got off the witness stand to describe pulling the trigger. He was not near a microphone, so it's hard to hear him in his own words during this demonstration. However, he says he fired in self-defense after his marijuana-smoking ex pointed a gun at him. He testified that it was a life-or-death situation for him, so he fired first. The whole argument started when he challenged his ex for smoking pot while pregnant.
I thought my life was over, and she just made me kill her brother. I thought Ron was dead. I didn't know exactly where I shot her at, but I knew I shot Ron close to his heart, because when we was touching it was on the break. So I knew where I shot him at, and he went down. So I didn't know exactly why I shot her at. So I'm thinking she still was alive. I didn't know she was dead. So I'm like, I don't know if you're gonna make it. I hope you do. I told you don't play with me, and you went and got a gun on me. And all I came out with a talk. You called me over, and all I wanted to do was a talk, and you went and got a gun. And now we paying the price. Your brother gone. You probably gonna lose a child, and now they finna kill me.
When you shot those shots at her, what was going through your mind?
I believe she had them armed herself.
Did you ever shoot her because you were angry at her?
No, I didn't shoot because I was angry with her.
Did you have time to think about
everything happened like this, and once Ron attacked me, he turned my mind into something else. He turned my mind into something. He attacked me. I didn't do nothing for him to attack me. I didn't do nothing to get no gun. And once he attacked me, he turned my mind into something else. And I was just reacting, Mary. I was just reacting. Even when they opened the door, I just reacted. I fired two shots, I just reacted. He had my mind somewhere else. I never meant for this to happen. I wanted my child. I'm not going to kill my sister. I'm not going to kill my queen. I wanted my child. I didn't want that. I never wanted that. I ain't never been there. All my life, I looked out for people. All my life, I did for my people. This city loved me.
This is incredible testimony. On cross-examination, Markeith Lloyd, who pulled the trigger and killed two people, told the jury that he was the real victim in this case. Listen to this.
Said that wasn't the whole text message. He's admitting just half of stuff like the news do to try to prove some point that ain't there.
The text message that said, in part, I hope you don't make it. You didn't.
That was
not what you
no.
Didn't
no.
What I'm, my question to you is, none of this is your fault?
No.
In fact, you're really the victim here today, aren't you?
Of course I am.
You went to trial?
Yes, I went to trial.
Jury heard the officer's side?
Yes.
Jury heard your side?
Yes, and the jury seen me get arrested in court, too. A whole bunch of...
You got found guilty?
SWAT team came in and got...
You got found guilty?
Yes.
But out there on the side of the road, it was the police officer who started this and put you in pain and really kind of caused the whole problem.
Yes, he grabbed my hand, and he went to squeeze and twist my hand, telling me he don't give a...
Once again, you were the real victim there.
Of course I was.
Also with me tonight here on The Debrief, our attorneys Eklund Mercy and Linda Kenny Bodden, along with retired Los Angeles Police Sergeant Cheryl Dorsey. So Cheryl, can you believe this defendant? He shoots his ex, he shoots a cop, basically kills them both, and he says he's the victim. How do you react to this?
Well, listen, I knew all along, based on the machinations that he was going through with his attorney, because he was much involved, that all they really needed to do to ensure a conviction was wind him up and put him on the stand and let him go.
Like clockwork. Linda Kenny Bodden, is this guy doing himself any favors by reacting that way?
Well, yesterday when he was on the stand initially, he actually seemed pretty good in the sense that he believes what he said. And he even told them, look, I was arrested in court. They sent a SWAT team in. He told them all about his arrest. But then today on the cross-examination, when he starts saying he's the victim here, victim here, victim here, victim here, one sees a bit of paranoia and one sees somebody who obviously could go off just like that, just like he said he did, and shoot someone.
I watch him snap. I'm sitting there thinking that the other surviving victim, the brother, has something behind his story because he said basically that this defendant snapped. Eklund Mercy, I can't wait to hear your opinion on this. Is this guy going down or what? Give us your take.
I don't know because he's the thing. He's lightweight brilliant. And he makes his own objections from the stand. Did you not peep the speculation objection? He said it. I don't know what's in his mind. He is the far ahead of the curve. You cannot, if you're the prosecution, you cannot underestimate Mr. Lloyd at all. Do not do that because you will mess up. I don't know. He could be pretty compelling because he's very regular. I mean, because his cadence is just very normal. He is acting it out. He is saying, this is what happened, this is what I said, this is what I did. It's really hard. I don't know. I don't know what the jury's going to think.
Yeah, I mean, I guess we don't. Linda Kenny Bodden, my guess is that you would have been trying to counsel this guy to not take the stand.
Well, yeah, except for the fact that there's one slight problem. It's a defense case, really. It's a stand your ground, so he kind of has to take the stand. And let me tell you, there is no way you were ever keeping Markeith Lloyd off the stand. But I don't ever want to hear anybody complain about my allegedly crazy clients again, because this guy is dangerous, in my opinion.
Okay, Linda Kenny Bodden, I'll give you the final word on this case. And still ahead tonight here on The Debrief, testimony about forensics in the case of a Florida doctor beaten to death with a hammer, plus a verdict in the penalty phase of a trial involving gangs, divorce, dentists, money, and a murdered law professor you see right there. Is it life in prison or the death penalty for one defendant? Let's go now to day four of testimony in the case of a Florida doctor beaten to death with a hammer. A friend discovered the body of Dr. Teresa Severs after she did not show up to work. The hammer authorities say was used to kill her was near her body. Nothing, including money, in her home was taken. Police think her husband asked for help to kill her. Investigators say that husband, Mark Severs, hired his friend, Curtis Wright, and Wright's friend, Jimmy Rogers, to commit the crime. Rogers is on trial now. Wright cut a deal and will testify against Rogers. Severs faces a separate trial at a later date. Sheriff's deputies from Lee County, Florida, traveled to Missouri to interview the defendant on trial right now. He was in jail there on federal charges unrelated to this case. One deputy described in court their surprising conversation.
So as we were going in there to set up, and when I mean set up, move the chairs, have our digital recorder going, while we were about to start that process, Mr. Rogers was suddenly in front of that glass window, unexpectedly. It appeared to be unexpected for him also, because when we first saw him, he began demanding of us in a very loud voice, "What are you doing here? What's going on? why am I here? You better tell me, or I'm leaving. And I said, you're being charged. You saw what you were charged with. It's homicide, second-degree murder.
What did he do?
He said to us, well, in the state of Missouri, second-degree murder is 15 to 20 years, and I'm okay with that. And before I could say another word, he walked out of view.
The defense says it plans to call more than 20 witnesses as that case moves forward. A verdict, meanwhile, in the penalty phase of the trial against a man convicted of murdering a Florida law school professor. Sigfredo Garcia and Catherine McBonowa were accused of killing Dan Markell. The state said the motive was Markell's divorce and custody battle from his ex-wife, Wendy Adelson. The jury convicted Garcia, but was hung on McBonowa. A third defendant, Luis Rivera, admitted guilt and cooperated with the state. The state asked the jury to recommend the death penalty.
Garcia chose the lifestyle, which included drugs and booze and 100-mile-an-hour wipeouts. This moment here today is a culmination of all the choices that he has made in his life. Dan Markell didn't get a choice in any of this. His death was the product of a cold, calculated act driven purely out of greed. The aggravators in this case have been proven beyond a reasonable doubt, and they outweigh any mitigation that you might find that the defense has presented. You should now bring your best judgment to bear in making a decision as to what the appropriate sentence is for what this man did. And that judgment should be a recommendation of death.
Even at this stage of the case, Sigfredo Garcia's attorneys still pointed the finger elsewhere.
We believe, and we've told you, that Luis Rivera, it's been our position, has been the shooter. And I know you found him guilty of first-degree murder, and we respect it. But if you believe that there's a principal theory and that Luis Rivera was the real shooter, that should be something considered, too. You know, we find ourselves in a scenario where we're asking you to choose someone's fate, the ultimate fate. And we're asking you to consider those four steps. All four of them don't need to be taken. If we get to step two and you want to jump off, jump off. If you get to step three and you want to jump off, jump off. And if you get to step four, jump off. Give this guy life. That's the appropriate sanction in this case.
Earlier, Dan Markell's mother talked about the grief of losing a child.
Dan's murder has not only deprived his large network and community of a dedicated and caring family member and friend, it has also deprived the world of a brilliant attorney, teacher, and legal academic. Benjamin was 4 years old. And Lincoln was only 3 years old when their father was murdered. Benjamin and Lincoln have been forever deprived of a relationship with their father and will grow up and go through life without a father. There is not a single day that goes by when thoughts of Danny do not enter our minds. His murder has been horrible for us, shocking, surreal, hard to understand. Danny is never coming back, but we continue to hope and pray for justice.
Let's listen now as the judge reads the jury's aggravating factors and the ultimate decision.
As the aggravating factor, the capital felony was committed for pecuniary gain. The capital felony was a homicide and was committed in a cold, calculated, premeditated manner, without pretense of moral or legal justification. The state did not prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the aggravating factors outweigh the mitigating circumstances. And the jury, having found you guilty of murder in the first degree and conspiracy to commit first degree murder, I do adjudicate you guilty of each offense. On count one, I sentence you to life in prison. On count two, I sentence you to 30 years Department of Corrections to run consecutively to count one. As to count three, based upon the jury verdict of not guilty, I adjudicate you not guilty of that offense.
Let's bring Cheryl, Linda, and Eklund back in for some analysis on this case. So Cheryl, what do you make of the verdict here, the ultimate sentence, I should say? We know the verdict.
Well, I mean, what a gift. right? He gets life in prison. You know, he's relatively young. He could conceivably maybe get out and do what I don't know, but wow, what a gift. I'm a little disappointed.
Well, yeah, but he's getting life on the first one, and then he's got this back-to-back 30 years on the second one. So, Eklund, I don't think he sees the light of day. You know, what's your analysis of this in the end?
I personally think that the jury is sending a message that they need to indict the people involved. The state had the wheel of conspiracy up, and the people that had the money and the complexion weren't indicted and weren't a part of the case. Matter of fact, you gave Wendy Edelson immunity. That is confusing to the jury, and I think that the jury is sending a message that, hey, if you're gonna indict, if you want him to look, you want him dead, but yet and still we have people out here that you have enough evidence against and you haven't indicted them.
Eklund, I think you might be onto something here. You know, we've got Wendy Edelson. She's up on the stand, says she knows nothing about it, but she's the one, prosecutor said, who had the motive. And then her brother, prosecutor said, was the one making the phone calls to basically the alleged conspirators here. Linda Kenny Bodden, do you think Eklund's onto something?
Right. Also, it gives the prosecution the ability to go back and say, well, maybe you can get the light of day. You can flip on the family. We need a witness. We need a cooperator besides that, and then get to the family. But the family obviously sees Luis Levere get an effective 7-year sentence above his federal sentence. They gave, they were mistried on Cafe Magbanua. So life is probably sounds pretty even keeled for this jury, given all the rest.
Yeah, Linda, if you're Catherine Magbanua, she potentially is going to be tried again here. What are you thinking if you're her?
She's going to plead guilty. There's going to be a plea in the case, in my opinion, because she's useless to the prosecution right now because she really wouldn't dime out the Adelsons on the stand.
You know, she had a chance to do that before. She didn't take it. And who knows? Maybe that'll change at this point along. We appreciate the insight from the panel here on The Debrief. The Debrief will be back as usual live at 5 o'clock on the Law and Crime Network. Live trial coverage of these cases picks up tomorrow at 9 a.m. Eastern. We'll see you then. Have a good night, everyone.